Well, that's cleared the ground. But let's go on and ask what I think is the more pertinent question. And a number of psychologists, let me say, have already said this sort of thing. It's not entirely novel to me. Do we need immediate memory? Now, it's very difficult to classify memory. We know there's a very long-term memory, and we know there's sort of in what's called often short-term, it is intermediate. We also know there's a very short-term memory, which I'm going to call immediate memory, and what appears to operate in REM sleep. And I'm going to make the postulate, this is a postulate, that if one of the essential features, not the only essential feature of consciousness, is that you must have immediate memory. Now, I've got used to this idea, so it seems to me now plausible. But I have to try and make it plausible to you. And I can only do it by an argument which I would admit under cross-examination is a slight cheat. Let's imagine that you have a person who, as it were, in some sense, that's where the cheaty bit comes in, was dreaming, but he had no immediate memory. And you woke him up. Wouldn't be able to tell you anything, because he would have no immediate memory. It would have all have disappeared. When you think of it that way, it does seem as if one of the attributes of consciousness is you can remember what has just happened, and maybe just a tiny bit more. So why don't we start with that and see where we can go when we address it that way? Now, in order to do that, I have to make some general remarks, and I hope the psychologists will forgive me because they're very general and simple, about the nature of memory. I won't dwell on the fact, though it's well known, there's at least two types of memory. There's a memory called episodic memory, which is roughly remember what you had for breakfast, and then there's what some people call procedural memory. There are a whole lot of pairs of terms, because they don't agree what the difference is, which is how you ride a bicycle. What H.M. has lost is his episodic long-term memory, long-term memory, but he still probably has his procedural memory. He can learn to do motor tasks. He can learn to do, although again one could query technical details, a little problem called the Tower of Hanoi, and each time he does it, he gets better, but each time he does it, he denies he's ever seen it before, because his episodic memory, long-term memory, doesn't record it, but he certainly gets better. Now, when you think about what we mean by memory, certainly in this thing, there appear to be, at least it's useful to think, I should say, in terms of three operations. You've got to put the thing into the memory. You've got to put it in some way. And for that, we believe you need neural activity. We believe that in general, neurons have got to be firing. Again, couldn't be completely sure, but it seems very plausible. If something's got to be remembered, the neurons have got to be firing in some way. Then you've got to store it. You may store it for a short time, you may store it for a long time. If you store it for a long time, most people would believe it isn't because the neurons go on firing for years and years and years, but that you've altered something structurally. You've altered the strength of the connections, probably distributed over a large number of connections. You've strengthened some, you've weakened others, and so on. And you've remembered that, and the connections which make up a particular letter, for example, are then sufficiently strengthened that one lot will excite the other or whatever, and so on. The point about that is that's the storing, and it may in some sense be structural. But of course you've got to get the memory out. It's no use it sitting there doing nothing in your brain. If you want to use the memory, you've got to access it, and you've got to bring it out. And what we believe is that when you bring it out, you're going to express it again in terms of neural activity. Now, these things may be slight exaggerations and oversimplifications, but I do think they're probably on the right lines. So with that preamble, what can we say about possible forms of immediate memory? Remember, before I talked about long-term memory. Now we're coming to immediate memory. We still have to put in, store, and get it out again. Well, you can have something which was what's called a reverberating circuit. This neuron excites this excites this one, and 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 it comes back again, and the thing goes round and round. That was fashionable some time ago. We don't know of any, I think, that happens, but we have to put it on the list of things that might happen. And you could imagine it happening intermittently, that there was a pulse, and this pulse traveled round, and the pulse came back again. So it doesn't necessarily have to be continuous firing. It would depend how long it takes to go around the circuit and how long the pulse was. Again, these are all very simple ideas rather than some precise things that you would think about in exactly how neurons behave. You can imagine, for short-term memory, that a few neurons simply go on firing. There have been changes made in their ion gates or their thresholds or something or other, and they simply go on firing. And we certainly think that that can happen. But there is another possibility, which is the following. In long-term memory, remember, you had to weaken, or weaken or strengthen synapses. People study this, incidentally, they call it LTP and so on in the hippocampus. We needn't go into all that. But you could have the same thing in short-term memory. And so you can ask the questions, which of those things happen? Now, there is one advantage in storing things in the strength of a connection, rather than things going round and round, is, as it were, a connection keeps itself to itself. But all these circuits going round and spreading out in all directions are apt to interfere with everything that's going on, which you may want or you may not want. So it's quite an advantage to be able to store something as a temporary alteration in the strength of connections. Well, then we have to ask, of course, is there any experimental evidence at all for short-term alterations in the strength of synapses? And the rather bizarre thing is, this has been known for years. It used to be studied quite extensively in the 50s. It has a name. The name is rather misleading because it was mainly done at the neuromuscular junction, where the nerve comes onto the muscle. And it was called PTP, which stands for post-tetanic potentiation. You certainly needn't remember the name. And it turns out that the people studying that, and there are still people studying it, find there are four processes. Three of them strengthen the connection because of activity. One of them weakens it. Now, broadly, what you do to test this is you put in a little test and you see what effect. You put in something coming down the axon, or axons as the case may be. You measure the effect. That's your baseline. Then you send in a pulse of some sort. Depends, different people use different pulses and different lengths and so on. And then, you have to do it in rather a short time sometimes, you send in another pulse and you see whether the result is bigger or smaller. And you infer that you've strengthened or weakened the connection. There is a process, you needn't bother about the names, called facilitation. Now the interesting thing is that when you've strengthened it, it decays with a certain time. And it's after all that time we're interested in, because we're interested in very immediate, short-term memory, and that has times in the range of 50 or 100 milliseconds. That really is quite immediate. There's another process, which has been called augmentation, which decays in a second or so. That's also within the range we're interested in. And there's one a bit longer, which is also called potentiation, which is a matter of minutes. And these times are somewhat similar in different species and in different temperatures and so on. In fact, there seems to be a compensation of the two. And then there's a fourth one called depletion or depression, which if you do it too much, you get a lesser effect. Now, of course, you can say that's not very well, but I'm quite sure I'm not just conscious at my neuromuscular junction. And what I want to know is, do these processes, which are fairly well known, although the biochemistry is only surmised, I think it'd be fair to say, do they happen elsewhere? And they're known to happen in the hippocampus. The only thing that is, the first three processes are similar, there is rather less depletion. So unfortunately, you can't take the results from the neuromuscular junction and assume it's going to be exactly the same anywhere, everywhere. And we believe, but I don't think it's certainly not been done properly, there may be processes like that in the neocortex, and most physiologists would guess so. I will say, and this is a remark in parenthesis, and it's what's called presynaptic. It depends on the activity coming in here and not the activity here and the activity here. That's called Hebbian. It appears to be presynaptic, and that means you strengthen all the terminals of one axon. In other words, you're boosting up one neuron, But for all we know, that's probably what you want to do in order to have it, as I'm going to suggest, that possibly this is part of the basis of consciousness. Of course, it isn't enough merely to strengthen the synapse, which means you have a little short-term memory potentially there. You must be able to access the memory. So the thing that we don't know, and what is the weakest in this set of ideas, is which parts of the brain can, as it were, go back and fish it out again or see the after effects. And I think we shall have to think about the presynaptic side of it and the addressing problem. So now you can ask, where... that essentially what we're trying to do is, what you want to be conscious of is the results of the subroutines. You don't want to see all the thing that's going on at the very lowest level. That has to get through the system, of course. It can get through and so on, because you can operate on more than one level at once, and the searchlight may help you to do that. But essentially, what is important and what you want to make conscious is the results of these earlier calculations. And so on. And this answers the question of what is then important and suggests that we should look for mechanisms which are produced in that way, especially by rapid firing. Now, if I had to do a more extended one, I would have to discuss how it can be done with less rapid firing. And of course, things will get through the system even if they're not firing rapidly and may make some strengthening of connections. That would correspond to a subliminal effect. It isn't big enough to bring it up so that you can make something really fire rapidly and become conscious, but you may strengthen the connections enough so when something comes around the next time, then you boost it up. So you can explain those sort of results, at least in general terms. You must remember this is only very general terms. So now we can really address our question is, can we say in outline on this very simple model, what is the neural correlate of consciousness? Well, first of all, we can say it's probably not everywhere in the brain. It certainly isn't at the neuromuscular junction. There may not be much in the spinal cord. You could certainly worry about the cerebellum and so on and so forth. It has to be a place that you can address in some way. But on the other hand, that could be many places in the brain. So it will probably be a subset of places in the brain. And at any one moment when you are conscious, what it would mean is that some of those places are very active. And a moment later, some other places are very active. So the thing is shifting about on your head very rapidly all the time. And it's where the action is, as it were, that gets through and gets more and has bigger effects on the system, and which, remember, will make alterations which you can recall in some way, which we said was the essential feature we were looking for. So that, I think, sketches the thing in outline, and I can now recapitulate it and say what we postulate is that immediate memory is an essential component of consciousness. And it may be, I have to say may be, related to this well-known but understudied phenomenon called PTP, and therefore which certainly would be now exciting to look at in different parts of the brain. Another feature is that you're only going to access some of the information, which is probably an important subset, and for that we probably need to know more about the detailed wiring of the brain and what feeds back to what, and that certainly is not one which you can make a simple suggestion as to how to go. But what it leads to the conclusion is that consciousness is not an epiphenomenon. It's an important part of the system. And you could go so far as to hope that we shall be able to prove, when we understand it, that it's an essential feature of any very complex system. That it's essential to be able to have some information which you can access very rapidly, and it's not the entire information, and that's not a trivial thing. If you have a simple system, you may not need to do it. The more complex the system is, the more you are likely to need something of that sort. And finally, well, not finally, perhaps, but I should say it at this point, that what we need, I think, to is to face up to the problem. This has been a problem which has become very unfashionable, or was very unfashionable, partly original because of behaviorists, but even, I think, in branches of cognitive science, certainly in psychophysics and in the neurosciences, it's not a question which is in the forefront of people's minds, which is a pity, because it's one of the things we would most like to explain. And what I'm trying to say is that I don't think it's as difficult as it's made out, and I don't think that also that you can't begin to make suggestions as to how to tackle the problem. So what I've tried to outline for the early visual system is what is known, all those multiple maps and things, the way neurons fire and so on, the features they respond to, all which is puzzling enough. The sort of way we think it might work, which I'm sure you'll see we don't know, but there may be novel ways of thinking about the way we work, and some of the problems ahead of us. I can't hope to pinpoint them all, and I've only done with visual processing and early visual processing, and I don't want you to leave you with the impression I don't think there are a lot of other problems, and certainly problems which take longer than half a second, for example. There are very serious problems which we have to deal with, which I haven't touched on at all. But I think you can begin to see how we might tackle some of these problems. And that's the thought I want to leave you with. Thank you.
Crick has agreed to answer some questions.
Yes.